Actually, I haven't made as much progress as I would like because of my homework reading. Oh, where did I put it? I think it's upstairs. I don't see it. I must have written it in here. I don't often, or sometimes I should say, I don't write them on the first read through something because often I find the answer on the second. Ooh, so I think it was in the introduction, but I don't recall what it was.
Okay.
Apologize. First reading of something is really like a base coat of paint. That's what I think of. Everything gets filled in.
Yeah, it's good. I find that also, you know, whenever studying, you read something a second, third time, you know, in the matters of Torah, that is, it just has a way that the you see more and more as it unravels.
I do have a question regarding finding a rabbi to make halakhic rulings for you. Well, I guess, how does one go about that process of finding a reliable rabbi?
Become familiar with somebody who you trust. Or actually the trust will come through becoming familiar. If you assess somebody as having a good, good rounding in Torah knowledge.
Good morning.
Morning, Doug. Okay. So let's review the last verse. There we did. And let's make sure.
Good morning.
Good morning. The last verse we're in was Koheles chapter 10, verse 4. And the verse said that if the spirit or the anger, the spirit literally of the ruler rises up against you, which implies anger. Okay, Joe. Okay, Les. Very good. Two of our friends are online, so they just confirm we get the audio going well. Okay. So again, it's Koheles, chapter 10, verse 4. And King Solomon says, if the spirit of the ruler rises up against you, do not move from your place. because marpe means from the word healing. What does it say literally in the, let's take a look at the Targum. It says marpe. Let me, hold on one second. So, if you placate, that can avoid many great sins or a lot of evil that can happen to you. So that's the literal reading. Then we suggested one idea is that if a ruler is angry with you, so flee, you know, a person who flees is an expression of guilt. So if you stand your ground, just in a literal sense, and show respect also. So the respect itself is what can appease somebody who's at the gate. And we cited the case of King David when he called himself like a flea or a dog when King Saul was out to kill him. And by doing so, King David knew that that would defuse the situation. Because once he's bowing down and showing tremendous humility to King Saul, so now in King Saul's mind, he's conquered David, so the energy in order to reduce David had dissipated when he saw David in his low state. There was nothing, there was no challenge anymore. There was no need to put him down. David did it himself. So you can understand that that literally works. And that's a person who gets the power to, because he wants to have the respect of others. So when you give it to him, that's satisfying him. So that's another aspect of it. Right, and this is continuing, you could say, on what he said earlier in 2, that the heart of the wise is in the right and the heart of the fool is in the left hand. The heart of the wise is in the right hand. That means, we said, that it's readily available. The person who's wise, so since he's living by this lifestyle and he sees the value and he sees how the world operates, is purely through wisdom. Everything is operating by natural law. Natural law is guiding everything. Human nature, nature, external happenings, events, the properties of everything physical. I mean, anything that a person experiences in his life is all based on God's wisdom. So he abides by that in every area. So another explanation that the rabbis give is that if such an event happens where, for example, Ibn Ezra says that if a person, let me read to you, he says like this, he says, this is chapter 10, verse 4, Ibn Ezra says as follows, on account that it was mentioned earlier, that the words of the wise are heard better than the shouts of the ruler, of that are fools. So King Solomon returns over here to warn, advise the wise person that if through your wisdom you had risen to a level of rulership, which happens to people that have a good advice are sometimes recognized, and the rulers want to harness that for their own objectives. Right? Or sometimes the people can put the person in power too. But nonetheless, if a person does rise to a level of power because of his wisdom, like, for example, the case of Joseph. He doesn't say the word Joseph here, the name Joseph, but it's apparent. He says, for example, like the matter from the house of imprisonment, he went up to rule as a king. So that's pretty much Joseph. You don't have any cases like that otherwise. So he says, if this happens to you, so from your place, do not move. What does it mean from your place? So he says, and that's our verse, he says, the matter is like this, that the humility that you had, or the fact that you were involved, engaged in wisdom regularly, you should maintain that like it was at the beginning. Meaning, don't move from that state of mind. And don't try to follow rulership and oppose man. So again, he says, maintain that state of mind, the humility or that attachment, that firm hold that you have on wisdom. Evidently, he's saying this because there's a danger when the person rises to power. And what command in the Torah do we have that proves this? That there's a danger if a person rises to power. So there's a command in the Torah that counters this. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Is it the one where the king is supposed to write the Torah scroll and carry with it all the time, carry it with him all the time?
Exactly. Right. And it even says over there that he'll become arrogant and he'll feel more, you know, important than his brothers. So there's a danger there. Okay. So that's Ibn Ezra. And he says you should know that if you appease and show deference to the rulers, this can remove a lot of injury to yourself, a lot of injury. And Joe is also right. Joe is mentioning that he shouldn't increase horses and wives and so on, because there's a tendency that with power to satisfy the great desires. So he says, in this matter, this is really an application of the verse where the wise man is hardest always in the right hand. That means his intelligence is always readily available. It's readily available because he never abandons intelligence. He sees that that's how the world operates. An intelligent person wants to function within how things work, not go against it. And here is an application. It could be, maybe he uses the most extreme application, the extreme case, where a king would rise up against the person. So hold your ground and your composure and don't let go of your wisdom. Use intelligence. And as Sforno says, he says another very important point. He says as follows. If the spirit of the ruler rises up against you, from your place do not move. Because at times, you will need to speak upon the heart of the ruler with your wisdom. And deference and respect to him will diffuse many great possible injuries. And he says, therefore, the speech of the wise men were soft. Or they resolved, they had a healing effect. Because a ruler will incline his ears to the words of the counsel of the wise people. So you see, why is a person who's a ruler? He's there. He can't be a fool and become a ruler. There have to be some intelligent steps that he took. So he does respect intelligence. It may not be for the highest value, like we say, learning lishma, like a person should learn. The highest level of study, of learning in life, in any area, is where he's learning for the sake of the learning itself and not for any other ulterior motive. Whereas people in power, their real goal is they'll put up with a lot of pain and ridicule and energy and lack of sleep and expense just to have that position. So really their goal is position. So they'll use everything as a step to get there, including wisdom. So they still will pay attention to wisdom. So if you are confronted with the situation, if a person's wise, he will maintain his wisdom, because that will be something which the king will show deference to him. So he, the king might, for some whatever, whether it's baseless or whether it has a basis, that a ruler becomes angered with you, using wisdom is something which he's going to listen to, because he does respect that for in some capacity. That's the sworn oath. Don't move from your place, which means that employ wisdom. Okay. Now he moves on to new ground. So we'll start the. Let's make some inroads now in the next verses that we didn't cover yet. Okay, unless there's any questions here.
Good here.
Okay. Yeah, Rashi gives a different. We didn't do Rashi. Let's just do Rashi on verse 4. So he says that if a ruler rises against you, meaning a ruler of the world, meaning he's talking about God. Rashi says the words, the Moshel Ha'olam, the ruler of the universe. So that could only be God. So if God rises against you, evidently some negative things are happening to you, because how else would you know that God is rising against you unless there's something negative happening in your life? Right? Of course, we don't know for sure, but he's saying, okay, let's say we know for sure. Let's say some sort of a miracle happens. But he's saying, again, Rosh is talking in theory, that if this happens, and God does this in order to examine after you, to examine you in terms of God's trait. Of course, he has no traits, but in terms of looking at you, in terms of judging you, assessing you, your merits against your sins. So Rashi says, if that's what happens, he's saying that's what this verse is talking about. So he says, he continues, he says, from your place do not move, from your character traits that are good, do not abandon them, and say to yourself, quote, what good did all this, my righteous, do to me? Look what's happening. I'm having a negative turn of events in my life, and I've been righteous, been keeping the Torah. So Rashi says, if you have a negative turn of events, do not budge. Do not abandon your good and say, what use was it? Why? He says, because it will be a healing thing to you. What is going to be healing? Rashi says, this examination of justice in terms of any afflictions that you have that come upon you, they will be a healing to your sins, and they will cause you not to encounter greater calamity. What does he mean? He's saying that if these afflictions come upon you, it really is a healing for you. Joe, you're asking, does Rashi say this in the conditional? Yeah, he's saying, if the afflictions come upon you. All right? So then, don't abandon, don't say that, what good was my righteousness? Now, of course, a person who's intelligent will never say that, because a person's righteous regardless of what happens, because he knows that being righteous is right. Giving charity to a poor person is the right thing. There's no way his mind is going to say, and no matter what happens to him in his life, that was an error. He knows that's true. He knows that if a person's innocent, he shouldn't be accused. So a person who's intelligent never accuses an innocent person. And let's say a person goes even further, and he defends an innocent person with his speech, and then he gets ridiculed. So then he ends up bearing the brunt of this. He's not going to feel any remorse for the fact that he defended the innocent person, because that was the right thing to do, regardless of what happens afterwards. But Rashi evidently is talking about a person who's not really quite on that level. And he's still looking to have some sort of recompense for his repayment for the good in his life. Well, listen, I was good. I did all the good in life. And now I'm having a terrible turn of events. So sometimes a person will start questioning, well, what good was everything that I did keeping the Torah? So Rashi warns this person, and he's not going to the full extent of advising the person here. Rashi's making one statement based on King Solomon's words. He's saying that this is really a healing. Don't look at this as something which is negative. Really, this is a positive. Because this is now going to be a healing to you for your sins. And it'll cause you not to encounter. And it'll cause you to avoid even greater mishap in life. So having some small problems right now is going to be a benefit to you because it'll help you in the long run. You won't encounter the greater problems. So let's understand what Rashi means. Okay? Unless you're asking, so it is a kind of correction. A wise person will pause and ask why is this happening and reflect upon their actions and deeds. Yes. Very good, Les. Okay, but how is this going to make the person avoid the greater mishaps in life later? As you see, Rashi's reading the verse another way, and it's not a conflict. It's just another way that you can read this verse, and it's also true. I mean, you could have one verse that has a number of true meanings. Of course, when you have conflicting interpretations of a verse, then they can't both be right. But here they aren't conflicting. They're complementary. One is talking about when you're actually in the face of a physical human ruler, how do you deal with him? Right? Ibn Ezra and Sforno take that angle. Rashi's talking about, no, the ruler here is God. So if you're being examined on your deeds and then you see that your life is taking a turn of negative events, so then he shouldn't abandon all the good that he did because this can actually be a good thing. Now that's our question. How is this going to be something which helps him and avoids the greater damage in the future? All right, everybody has a question? Jim, Doug, Rivka?
Just to reiterate, so the question is, if something bad turn of events comes about, how is that going to turn out to be a positive thing for him in the future?
Yeah, how will it help him avoid even greater calamities? I mean, he's suffering because of some relatively smaller misgivings in his personality. And this is really, he should welcome this and not abandon being righteous and living the right Torah life, because this is going to somehow help him avoid greater calamity. How is it going to work, is our question. Exactly.
Well, if he hadn't had the affliction, and he's got the character flaw, then it would seem that the character flaw would continue to get worse. But that if it's stopped at a certain point, and he reflects upon it, and because of the affliction fixes that, then it will prevent him from having further, I guess you could say, applications of that character flaw in the future.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, that's what Les is saying in Colorado, too. I mean, to say that if something negative happens, and this does not have to be necessarily God's hand. It could be, like Rashi's saying, it sounds like Rashi's talking in terms of a providential intervention, and not something negative happens, but I can give you, then it corrects him, and it wakes him up to this element in his nature, so he halts it. And this will save him from maybe expressing that poor character trait. Let's say he talks back to somebody. And because of that, the friendship is on the rocks for a month or two. And that bothers him. But then he reflects, and he sees that in his personality. So he now is aware of this part of his nature of wanting to talk back, to retaliate. And now once he's aware of it, he can control it. Because when you're not aware of an emotion, it can just act out. So it's a blessing, because maybe he'd go on a job interview in 6 months from now that would have a great salary. And because he's now aware of this personality trait of talking back, he guards himself in that interview. He doesn't talk back. He may sense that he has an emotion, but being aware of it, he can control it, and he ends up getting the job. Now, that could have been a greater calamity of losing a job that could, you know, sustain him and his family for years. So you can see very clearly how, even without intervention, just because that's the way the world operates, it's designed in that way. God designed the world in that way. Gemara talks about what are considered afflictions, and it gives a different level, a number of different types of afflictions. Actually, Doug, Jim, Ricky, you have the book, so I put a chapter in there on this. It was actually a question from a friend of mine, his brother, had this question about two different places in the Talmud where it talks about what are afflictions. So I went through it to show that there's some are just natural and some are divine. And how do you know which is which, and what exactly are the insights that you can derive from them? So you could explain this Rashi on both counts. It could be where God is doing it providentially, that he's intervening in your life to wake you up to something, and he's giving you a negative turn of events to awaken you to something about your personality. You can catch it, and if you can control it and master that part of your personality, then it won't act out in cases where it could be even more severe. Or it could just be, like we gave the case of a person speaking back. If you could just learn from how reality operates, you could see that speaking back is not going to be a wise thing. There's no gain. Intelligence is always the approach. So by having that one, you know, setback with a friend, where the relationship now is on the rocks for a brief period of time, it wakes him up to this part of his personality, and he'll be in control of it and not lose out because of it in the future on even greater attainments.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I remember asking you a question in relation to just what you were saying. If we take the time to look at what happened and really look at it squarely and not try to avoid what we can take the blame. We can say, well, I did cause this. God didn't put me through this. We don't have to blame God every time something goes wrong. We have to look at ourselves for the things that we do, that we create. It's not only, well, look, you know, God is running the world, but certain things he's not running, and that's the part what we choose. We choose the freedom of choice. When we have freedom of choice, Hashem actually gives us the right. It's like when you said to me, it's like standing, that Hashem is standing on the building, and he knows exactly what you're going to do. You can go right or you can go left. If you go right, you're going to meet somebody who you don't like, and you'll have a fight with that person because you haven't learned yet to control yourself. If you go left, you'll avoid the whole thing, but you're also avoiding correcting yourself. You were very sharp at the time, and you said that you can't blame God for everything. He's running the world, but you have the freedom of choice to make decisions, and you have to take responsibility for that.
Yeah, the Talmud says that everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. That means free will God does not tamper with. And many times, like Maimonides says, the majority of mishaps that a person experiences in life are self-afflicted. Most things that are negative in a person's life, he's doing himself. He doesn't. A lot of people don't reflect, so they blame external causes.
Right, okay. Totally wrong. Infantile position for their life.
Yeah.
They're laughing. And when people have family, friends, those around them, learn the same behavior and can create a lot of hostility. They're all doing the same thing, so there's like World War III all the time.
Yeah, could be. Okay. All right, so the next verse we're up to now, I didn't really prepare, but let's take a look at them and see what we can make some headway. All right, any other questions?
No, I'm good.
Good here.
Yeah, is Cal with you, Doug?
She is.
How you doing, Cal? She's quiet last week or so.
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Good. Have you been in touch with Francesca or Carolyn? Who else usually joins us?
I'm here. Hi, Rabbi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. I'm fine.
Good. Okay. So next verse, new ground. So this is 10:5, and it says as follows. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, like an error that goes out from before the ruler. Okay, Les, thanks. Thanks online. So he says there is an evil that I see that happens under the sun, like an error that goes out from before a ruler. Evidently, we have to read further because he doesn't tell us what that is. The fool is placed in many great heights, meaning exalted positions. The fool ends up in exalted positions. And the rich, or the wise, as I think Ibn Ezra says, he equates the rich with the wise. I'll have to get back to that. But the rich people sit in low places. So that's the evil that he's talking about. But he continues. He says, I see that there are servants, that they are on horses. They ride upon horses. Today, that would be equivalent to, a very fancy automobile. And then there's officers, that they go about as servants on the ground, meaning they have no means of transportation. They have to use their own feet. So in both verses, King Solomon is saying that the inverse is happening than what you should expect. Right, and so those three verses now. He calls it an evil. So let's take a look, and you tell me what seems to catch your eye over here. We'll just line up the questions. Unless we can see some insight into the answers too. Say you're right, under the sun. Why does he have to say that? What have we learned about that over the years when we kept on seeing that term? What was he referring to?
Doesn't that refer to the physical world?
Okay. But more than that, there was a lesson that he was trying to give you. That was factual. Under the sun means on earth. Like we talked about that, under the sun, I'm not sure if I'm quoting a verse properly here, but I'm just, it's better to be a live dog than a dead lion. Right? Because that's in terms of a purely earthly assessment, we said. But we said that was an error. It was an error because what people do, and King Solomon is consistently quoting the false views just to bring them into the open. So people think when reading his book here that this is his own position, but it's not. And yeah, Les, you're right also with Jacob and Laban. But Jacob didn't lose everything. He actually gained everything. So initially Jacob was the servant. But he was able to gain the wealth while still serving, working hard for Laban, right? Who was bishop of Belos. All right, so you were talking about that Laban lost everything, correct? Yes, that would be a case like this. Right, Les. Okay. So when he says here that it's an evil under the sun, what can you say about that statement? But he also says one more thing. It's like an error that goes forth from the ruler. Right? So he's saying a number of things in that opening verse that we didn't see before. Well, actually, we saw that under the sun before, but this idea about like an error going forth from the ruler, that's something that has to be understood also, okay? So I'm going to point you to elements of this that are significant. And then, of course, we'll have to ask, what is the sequence? How does this follow the previous thing about wisdom and talking back to the ruler and placating him, showing deference? Right, so there's a number of questions. But you're right, Doug, in your observation that you have people of that are foolish end up in positions of influence. They're in the heights. And the rich or the wise, you have cases where they're sitting on the ground.
So, based on all ships, if that's the right way to pronounce it, I wonder if the second half is saying if a ruler makes an error, it's probably a big deal in that it really has big, bad consequences. If an ordinary person makes an error, okay, there's a small consequence. But, you know, somebody I think once said, if you have a lot of money, it just allows you to make, you know, have the results of your decisions magnified that much more. And a ruler's kind of in the ultimate position. So if he makes an error, it's a huge deal with huge implications for society. So maybe that's what he's getting at, that this kind of thing that's described in 6 and 7 is something that has a huge impact on society in the same way that if a ruler had made an error, as opposed to just, it's somebody goofed, but it doesn't have that big an implication for the community.
No, I see. I mean, it throws a big question on the nature of things because it's coming from the ruler as opposed to, you know, your friend Bob next door.
Right. Like, if Bob decides he's going to get into a court fight with Harry, okay, so that creates a get into a fight with a neighboring country in error, that has huge negative implications for the whole country.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Whenever we've said in the past, under the sun, it was always the sense was that the person was assessing it as being a problem, as an evil, only because he was only assessing things on Earth and not the bigger picture. Like, it's an evil that, you know, the righteous and the wicked, they both have the same end. Right? He says that earlier. I felt like he's echoing the questions of justice that people in the world have when they look and they say, look, what use is it to be, why should I become wise? I'm going to die just like the wicked person dies. But that's only a question because the person's assessing things based purely on the scope of under the sun, of Earth. He doesn't look at the fact that there's an afterlife. So, it could be over here as well, the reason why he says there is an evil that he has seen under the sun. Why is he saying under the sun? Again, because if you just look at the human experience based on that you, there's nothing else but earthly life, then you're right. There's an imbalance. Why should the fool be on top and the righteous be, the rich be riding on the ground? But it seems to be indicated that's only looked at as an evil because of how you want to, you think that this is the entire, payback is only on Earth. So how could it be that the guy who works so hard, he's the wealthy guy, and he doesn't even get to enjoy the wealth, he's going to be in a low state? So the evil is because a person views this as being the only place where a person is rewarded. So if I don't see a person who's wealthy or righteous making it here, so then I have a big question in terms of justice. You see? That's why it says under the sun. And like you said, Doug, meaning it's like an error that went forth from the ruler. How could this happen? This is really what everybody's looking for. Position. Status, right? If we had to classify what these verses are talking about, it's talking about status. Nobody's saying that the people are starving. The rich person isn't starving. He's rich, but he just isn't riding he's not in a high position. And the servant is on the horse, whereas the officers are walking on the ground. That's only an evil also in terms of if you really have a value of status. That's why it's under the sun. And maybe when he's talking about it's like an error that goes forth because out of the mouth of a ruler. Because ruler is about position. This is a discussion about social status. And the ruler is the one that dictates that. So it could be that's where he indicates that at the beginning. It's like an error that went forth from the one who makes the decision about who's in what position in society. But there's another thing also. The fact that this comes right after where he told you that if you use intelligence, even if the ruler rises against you, you see, it's following on the previous verse, 4, was talking about the ruler too. So you start to see a little tie-in. And you could say like this, that although wisdom is something which of course can placate the ruler, you show deference to the ruler when he's angry with you, it will diffuse the situation. But nonetheless, that's not in all cases. And like Ibn Ezra says, he says on verse 7, this verse is from the matter of the first verse, he says. And on all of them, he says at the beginning, yesh, there is. Meaning, what does it mean, there is? What's the first verse is talking about. Where's the verse that says there is yesh, the word yesh? Yeah, that's verse 5. He says that's our verse. So what is he saying? He means to explain that this happens sometimes, few times. That's what Ibn Ezra says. It happens sometimes where you have a fool that could end up being a ruler. Typically, that's not the case. There are norms. There are natural norms that, you know, that nature follows. You know, for the most part, people who become rulers have intelligence. Right? We wouldn't deny that. And for the most part, the wealthy are in position of power. They're not low. But sometimes it's not that way. But I think he's bringing this up to show us that even though you have wisdom and you can talk to the ruler and you can show deference to him and that can help, it's not that way all the time. There's so many variables that exist that rules are in terms of the general. Meaning, but you don't have a control over all the variables. What internally is happening with this ruler? What psychologically, you know, how he's going to view you? Maybe you remind him of somebody that he hated years ago, and no matter what you do, you're not going to be able to be successful. So you still have to follow rules of what's the best thing I could do in this situation. But despite that, he throws in these verses now to show you it's not that way all the time. You could have these inverted situations where you have the, in terms of intelligence, things are inverted. That's verse 6. And in 7, it's not talking about intelligence. Now, it's just talking about you were born to a system where you were a slave. Somebody else was of royal lineage, royal blood. And sometimes it gets inverted. So that's not a matter of intelligence. Sometimes that could just be a matter in terms of what position, what role you're in society, and that can be inverted.
Rabbi?
Yes.
If that's the case, then why does King Solomon call it an evil?
It's an evil under the sun because he's echoing the opinions of people, not him. It's really the concerns that your typical person has, that cares about power. He doesn't think it's an evil. This is something which is, you know, people have an overestimation of, and they're bothered by this. Under the sun, meaning something which he thinks that this is everything to a person. You know, this life is everything to a person. Only what happens under the sun is what people care about. So to them, it's an evil. But it's not an objective evil because it's really not something which affects the person's soul, which, you know, traverses this world and the next world. So King Solomon is always going to be evaluating something based on the soul of a person. And he's not going to be concerned that a person is, you know, that you didn't have a high position in politics in this life. Do you think King Solomon would have that concern? I don't think so. But what he's doing is, like he did before, he echoes the opinions of the masses to bring it into the open, but he lets you know when he's doing that, because he says, under the sun. These are the views of the people that all they care about is matters of the earth. If I don't make it here, I don't care about the next world. I've got to have the fame, the fortune here. You see what I'm saying?
I think so. But are you saying then that what the verse is getting at is kind of a criticism against the whole idea of status per se?
Yeah.
So if that's the case, then why does he seem to only call it an evil when it's the reverse from normal rather than in totality? In other words, he doesn't seem to say it's an evil if a rich person sits in a high place and a foolish person sits in a low place.
Well, I mean, it definitely is a good to have intelligent people running the society as opposed to the fools. there definitely is benefit to that. I mean, we do have in the Torah, the endorsement of having a king. It's not prohibited. The Jews initially didn't ask for it properly. But nonetheless, God was with the rulers. He gave King Solomon wisdom. But the desire for the position per se is not something which a person should really value.
Rabbi?
Yeah. Let me just see if Doug answers your question.
Well, I can hear that for six, but I have trouble making that work for seven because there's no real detriment to society if slaves are on horses and princes walk on the ground.
Well, that's because you're intelligent, and the people of society do care about those things. So they're going to have that question. The masses are going to be concerned with position. All these little things. Who are you to say this to me? I mean, people are petty.
But you're saying that people won't care if princes are on horses and slaves are walking on the ground?
No, they accept that. That's the way it should be. That's something which people seem to accept. There's not an injustice there.
So your understanding of the verse is that he's saying that people in general have this idea about status and they would be upset if it were reversed from the normal.
Yeah. Because they will endorse it by chasing after it themselves.
Okay, I think I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hey, Rivka?
Yeah. You know, I was listening to what you were saying to Doug. I'm just wondering if there is a little bit, or people think in terms of what's today in the material kind of world, and I want it now, aren't they kind of saying in a small way, or maybe even in a loud way, I don't really believe there's an afterlife. I'm not even interested in the afterlife. I want it now because I want to be sure I get it, because I don't know if I'll get it later, and how will I get it? Is it going to be the way I want it, the way I deserve? Will I be able to argue for it? I think that a lot of people, maybe they put up a front and they say they do believe there's an afterlife, but maybe really they aren't. Because I think if a person is more of a calm nature and not worried of trying to win all the time and make a name for himself in this world, that he's Mr. Wonderful or Miss Wonderful, whatever, that they're thinking more in terms of building themselves to be the right kind of person that's going to earn the afterlife.
Yeah, we said that earlier, King Solomon said. He echoed the people that said that better to be a live dog than a dead lion. That's exactly what he means, that people have this position. As long as you're alive, that's it.
Okay, but isn't that also a little bit of evidence that the people are not really 100% thinking towards the afterlife?
Yes, yes, exactly. Because once you're dead, it's all over.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I was trying to bring out. Thank you.
Yeah, really, this is not something about these positions. It's an evil that people have because of concern solely about status. But this is only something King Solomon is mentioning to cite the error of people.
Right.
Then he gives two examples. One where you think that intelligence should keep the person at the top, but not always is that the case. But it's also a truth. I mean, it's a truth that sometimes things do get inverted. So it is a lesson to the intelligent person too. That listen, the rules they laid down that he says earlier that you can placate the king and so on, and use wisdom. You have to go by that. It doesn't mean you always get that response, but you do have minute cases where it's not going to work. That's because there are so many variables that you can't, take into consideration every single variable. And that's exactly what Ibn Ezra says. I mean, yes, that's why verse 5 starts off with the word There are some cases with an evil. That's what King Solomon is telling you. It's a minority of instances. But it happens. But then people focus in on that. But the truth is, it has to be that way. Because there are so many variables. If a person knew all the variables, he would understand that right now, this guy is a fool, will end up being in power because he sees everything that's leading up to it. Sometimes it just happens that way. Sometimes the variables just go that way. You know, cause and effect. Okay. But again, he's saying, and he's letting us know that this is not to be a real big concern, because this is only something which is on earth. This is not an absolute problem, because the in terms of justice and all, don't think that there's a loss to the intelligent person if in some cases he's now low, if that happens in the minority of cases, because justice is not meted out on earth alone. There is the next world. Right, he said that earlier. Okay. All right, if you look at the next verse, he goes back to showing you how, you see how he goes back and forth, that you'll have some minute cases that things will be inverted, but let's look at the next verse. Now, let me see, Les, you had a comment. It is something that can naturally happen under the sun, and the error from the ruler, the person brings these things upon himself. Yeah, it could be, this is self-inflicted too, Les. But look what King Solomon does now. In verse 8, he says, Doug, why don't you read this? You have the English there?
Verse 8, one who digs a pit
right.
will fall therein, and one who breaks a fence, a snake shall bite him.
Right. Read the next verse. Let's just see what that one says, too.
One who quarries stones shall be wearied by them. One who hews wood shall be warmed by it.
Interesting. You see the first one. I'm not sure if they're joined, but the first one, it says what? If a person digs a pit, he'll fall into it. If a person breaks open the fence, you know, he keeps out the snakes or whatever from his garden, but if he punches a hole in the fence, so now he'll get bitten by a snake. He's giving an opening to being hurt. The rabbis actually use this verse as a euphemism to, if you break down a law of the Torah, it'll damage you. That's what they use by the fence, because the rabbis are enjoined by the Torah only to create fences for the 613. They can't create a new law. God made a distinct number of laws. You can't add, you can't subtract. We just read this in yesterday's Torah portion. But God also said in Deuteronomy 17:11 that in accordance with the Torah that they teach you, you should follow. That means the rabbis have jurisdiction only in one area, to guard, to build up fences for the Torah. So they could make a second degree law that protects the primary law. They can't go further. They can't make a fence around their own rabbinic law. Like if they tell you that the Torah says that you can't uproot a branch. That's part of plowing. So you can't plow on the Sabbath. And breaking a branch off a tree is a form of uprooting from the ground. We see that clearly. So the rabbi said you can't ride a horse on the Sabbath because you may break a branch off the tree to hit the horse to make it move faster. So it's a rabbinic law that we can't ride a horse on the Sabbath. Because you might come to break a branch off a tree, which is God's law. That's one of the 613. So they have the right to make a rabbinic law to protect you from breaking a Torah law. But they can't make another law and say that you can't, stable your horse on the Sabbath, lest you come to ride it, lest you come to break it, because that's already too far removed. All they could do is one degree removed. So the rabbis also say that if you break down a fence, the snake will bite you, and that's this verse. That if you break a rabbinic law, if you think that's a light thing, it's not. I'm not really breaking God's law. It's only rabbinic. So if a person looks at it that way, he's going to hurt himself because the rabbis understood the need for certain rabbinic laws. So don't think and don't make small of it, because if you do that, the snake will bite you. Snake biting you means that you'll be hurt by giving in to the rabbinic. You know, if you violate, if you don't listen to the rabbis, it's going to hurt you in the long run. Just like if you break the fence, it'll make a hole and the snake will come and bite you. All right, side point. But what he does say is, he goes back to natural law again. You see here. So although he just told you that there is some small cases of deviation where the rich will be walking on the ground and the servants are going to be riding on the horses, nonetheless, he wants to bring you full circle and end off on the right note that there still is natural law. And that natural law is, you dig a pit, you're going to, meaning if you do something which has a negative potential, you can get hurt by it. You're going to fall into it. And if you break open a fence, you're giving a way for the snakes to come into your yard and get bitten, literally. So that's why I believe it was back to this point. We'll have to go further into it, but just in terms of what the sequence might be. And you could also maybe think about, what's the distinction between the two elements of this verse? Why does he have to give you two cases, a pit and a snake? What's the difference between the two cases?
One is a proactive creation of something that causes a problem, and one is destroying something that is preventing a problem.
Okay, good. Meaning you're creating a negative, a pit, where beforehand there was nothing. And in the other case, the fence is keeping out negative, and now you're acting on the fence, which was actually a preventive of a negative, okay? Yeah, I noticed another one that a pit is not necessarily something which is inherently damaging, but a snake is. I mean, a venomous snake. So you can do actions which have the potential for negative, and then you can do actions which are dealing with definite damaging elements too. All right, let's look it over. Let's hold it. We'll go into it at depth next week, and we'll see if it actually goes along with the next verse too. All right, so let's maybe we'll end it up here. Any questions or comments before we wrap it up today?
I think we're good here.
Okay. All right, so look it over for next week, and we'll pick up with this verse.
All right, Rabbi, thanks very much.
Okay, my pleasure, everybody. Enjoy the week.
Hello, everybody. Bye. Thank you. Be well.
Bye.
Bye-bye.